Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. Dan, got another exciting one today. We've had two exciting ones this week. On Wednesday night, Xavier beat Seton Hall 72-70. Today, Xavier beats Creighton at Creighton 82-80 in what was really kind of a wild game throughout the entire portion of it. And specifically during those final few minutes where neither team seemed like they wanted to win the game. And eventually, Xavier did just enough to close out the victory. Give me, just from a big picture, I tell you, Edmund Sumner goes down. Xavier's got a regroup after that St. John's win. What were you expecting heading into this week?
I think first of all, I thought the fact they were able to close out St. John's on the road was a huge thing for them, because that was just a loss they couldn't afford to take. Even without Ed, being able to kind of right the ship in those last few minutes was a big deal. But, I mean, you and I were texting back and forth before the Seton Hall game, like, okay, they got 10 more games. Is 5-5 good enough? That was what we were thinking. Like, is 5-5, 20-11, 10-8 in Big East play, is that good enough for an NCAA tournament bid? Because basically at that point I was thinking, well, if they can make the tournament, that's a pretty good result given the adversity they faced, losing Miles, not really ever having Miles, dropping 4 out of 5, the difficulty, you know, losing Ed, obviously. But now, I mean, it seems like 5-5 is well within their grasp. So yeah, I mean, I've been impressed. I think the biggest thing is, like, a month ago, we were talking about how Xavier never plays close games.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so going back to the Butler game, that's 7 in a row that have been pretty close down the stretch. And X has found a way to win. I mean, the Seton Hall game, the Creighton game, obviously the Creighton game is huge for a lot of reasons. I mean, what do you think it does in terms of an NCAA tournament resume?
Well, like you said, we were talking, this team, how does this team hang on and make the tournament, right? How do they still achieve an at-large bid, because they're not going to go to the Big East tournament and win that? So what do they need to do to just make it? And now they win this Creighton game, and they've also, like you said, closed out the St. John's game, closed out the Seton Hall win. So they've taken care of business in that regard. And you're just looking at it and it's like, well, wait, maybe we shouldn't be talking about how they stay in the tournament. Maybe we should be talking about what seed can they achieve again? Because you had a top 25. This was the win that was still left on their schedule that meant something, you know, that could maybe move them up a seed line still. So, you know, I think they're probably like a 7, 8, 9 type seed right now, depending on who you're asking. And obviously that's projecting a lot of different things, because none of this happens in a bubble. But with that win, I think, yeah, you're talking about them as anywhere between a 5 and 7 seed instead of a 6 to 8 or 9 seed. So I think it is a significant win. And I think more than anything, it just kind of caught me off guard that now all of a sudden the narrative for this team is a little bit different, I think, after that game. I think we should be talking a little bit differently about maybe this team can do more than just hang on and achieve an at-large bid. Maybe they can still get a reasonable seed.
Yeah, I mean, and I think where you have to start with this game is Tyreek Jones. 8 for 8 from the field for the game, 16 points, 4 rebounds. He gets a start again and makes himself known almost from tip. He scores on a stick back on the first possession, and then all of a sudden, and this is not something that I particularly expected, but Xavier goes directly back to him on the next two offensive possessions, and both times he just takes Justin Patton directly the hole and scores both times. Were you surprised by that? I mean, did you think that was a possibility in this game?
Dan, I have no explanation for it. Like, here's the thing. Rashid Gaston, in 19 minutes, outplayed Justin Patton's 28-minute performance, outside of, obviously, Patton really made an impact on the defensive end with the 5 blocks. Like, I'll
give him
that.
There was about a 2-minute stretch in the second half where he turned into Kenyon Martin.
Right.
But it was only for 2 minutes.
Right. But Gaston also had 2 blocks and played in great defense on Patton. So, like, those guys more or less canceled each other out, and Patton played 9 more minutes than Gaston did. Tyreek Jones completely dominated Justin Patton. I mean, I don't know how to explain that. They threw the ball in, other than here's what I would say, Dan. This may be the Mike Pegues effect. In like, we might be getting a great view of this and watching a really talented player progress from the start under Mike Pegues, and he may have just really accelerated Tyreek Jones' learning curve. Because all I expected out of Tyreek Jones this year was at some point he might slow down enough, the game might slow down for him, and he would recognize that he's athletic enough to dunk the ball around the rim, and he'd start doing that a little bit more. We really haven't seen him do that to this point. And what I would say about Mike Pegues' style, and sometimes I think especially like with Tyreek Jones, it has seemed counterintuitive at times, is Mike Pegues always starts by breaking stuff down to the footwork, getting the footwork right. You need to be able to shoot that midline jump hook with the proper footwork. You need to have the counter move when they stop you and play you high on the midline to where you can spin back, drop, step them, and score going towards the baseline. Like Mike Pegues is very particular about the details with the footwork. I didn't know Tyreek Jones had this below the rim, polished footwork, making moves up and unders, going underneath the rim and using it to protect him against the shot blocker and finishing with reverse layup like he did today to start the game, and acted like he knew it was going to happen from the tip and it was the game plan going in, which I can't imagine it was, other than maybe Mac was hoping to draw an early foul on Patton. But
yeah, that's kind of what I figured. I kind of figured they might go inside early just to try and get Patton in foul trouble, because they were able to do that in Cincinnati. And
but I assure you, they didn't have their first three plays drawn up to go at Tyreek Jones.
Well, no, certainly not.
And no one in the world expected him to finish all three. I will, much less all eight of his shots on the day.
Well, right. And in the second half, his minutes were managed a little bit more particularly, it seemed like. I don't know how much he really played in the second half. I'll actually figure that out.
I think he played 9 minutes in the first half and 9 minutes in the second half, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I think he played 18 minutes total.
Well, I guess the reason that I was thinking he didn't play as much in the second half was because Rasheed got all the minutes down the stretch, it seemed like, maybe for the last 4 minutes of the game.
Well, and plus, but after
you're right, Tyreek got 9 minutes in the second half.
Plus, after you score 10 points in 9 minutes in the first half, you feel like maybe that guy should be playing the rest of the game, is what I think a lot of people were probably thinking. So
yeah.
I saw a lot of people tweeting that, why isn't Jones in there? But again, Gaston played really well and was really good defensively. Plus, you know, there's the whole free throw thing, which Gaston went 1 for 2. Jones didn't shoot any, so not much to look at there. But, yeah, I think the Tyreek Jones thing, if you're a Xavier fan, you just have to be really excited about what you've seen from him over the last few weeks. And then you couple that with Quentin Gooden, and the future is really exciting. And, oh, by the way, they've also revived this team when everyone thought the season was dead. So the rest of this season might be really fun to watch as well.
Yeah, I mean, and so that kind of leads us into the sort of the first half of the game. I mean, Xavier started really hot. They had 22 points in the first 6.5 minutes of the game. They were only up 5 at that point because Creighton was quite good offensively as well in the early going. But then they went into something that's kind of, unfortunately, become a little bit of a trademark for them, which is a long offensive lull. I think they only had, like, maybe one field goal over the next 8 minutes. They got some free throws here and there, but it was a lengthy period of time where they just couldn't find ways to score. And as you were watching it, I mean, was there anything that stood out to you? Do you think they kind of went to sleep, or what do you think happened during that period?
They missed shots. And I know we were texting sort of through that time. And the thing, my point was, is percentages catching up. Like, they came out on fire and didn't miss for the first 5 minutes. Then it was kind of whatever for 2 or 3 minutes. And then they went ice cold for 5 minutes. And, like, well, if they would have just shot average for the first 5 minutes, maybe those 5 minutes wouldn't have been as bad. Like, that, I find that's just kind of how it works in basketball. It's a game of runs. I worried when it gets too extended. And sure, this team has had some really bad second half stretches recently. And I think that people are looking at that narrative and then applying it to these smaller stretches and being like, oh, it's a major problem. I didn't see a major problem. I saw a team on the road that missed a few shots and was actually running pretty good offense. Like, I would argue they were running better offense during that 5 minute stretch where they were missing shots than they did at the beginning. Because the beginning, it was like Tyreek Jones working in the post one on one and just dominating Justin Patton inexplicably. Quentin Gooden stepping into threes. Kaiser Gates, I think, crossed over and got fouled and like went to the rim. So, like, things that they don't normally do, and a lot of kind of just individual stuff. Trey hit a tough shot or two. So the 5 minute stretch where they weren't scoring, I didn't think like, oh man, they're being too individualistic and they're not moving the ball or anything. I thought they ran a couple nice sets and got good looks and then just didn't put them down.
Yeah, this team, and I don't know if it's an issue that's just particular to this team or if this is something that you see throughout basketball, but Xavier, usually when teams run good offense, they score, right? They hit shots. I mean, because generally you get better, you run good offense, you get better looks, you probably finish those at a higher percentage. This Xavier team, sometimes their ability to finish and the quality of the offense they're running has no relationship with one another.
Yeah.
Sometimes they are playing just ridiculous hero ball, like maybe in the first half against UC, and guys are just standing on their head, making crazy shots, and they're scoring lots of points. And then sometimes, like we saw maybe the last 3 minutes of the first Creighton game in Cincinnati, they're running superior offense, getting great looks, and can't throw the ball in the ocean. So, I mean, you got an explanation for that?
First of all, it's a really good point by you. Second of all, I think maybe the only thing I would say to that is look at the personnel. Their star players, JP Makira, those are like, that's kind of their style, right? It's Trayvon's an isolation bucket getter type of guy that does a lot of one-on-one stuff and is a guy who makes tough shots. And same thing with JP. JP wants to get in a rhythm and then just fire. Like, no matter what type of shot it is, he just wants to find that rhythm on offense. And he doesn't have any type of conscience in terms of what shot he's taking. So that's the only thing that kind of makes sense.
This is a total off the mark thing.
Sure.
But something I've noticed recently is that JP's body suits seem to be getting baggier as each game goes on.
You think he's less aerodynamic?
I'm half convinced that he's going to come out for like the Marquette game on senior night in like a beekeeper costume.
That'd be a good look.
For saying
with the helmet and all.
Yeah, maybe.
That would be good. I could go for that. No, that was all I had. Really, is just maybe it's just because kind of the guys that tend to try to lead them offensively are guys that are just streaky sort of one-on-one type of players at times.
Yeah, and I think that one thing about this particular game that maybe wasn't true some of the offensive lapses they've had in the past is that they didn't, at least during that period where they were struggling offensively, they didn't totally give up defensively. Like they didn't, you didn't see corresponding drop in defensive intensity as they got discouraged. Because during that period, I mean, Creighton did outscore them and did build a little bit of a lead. But typically, if you figure that you're going to score 2 points in 9 minutes at Creighton, you are going to get your doors blown off. And that didn't happen. I mean, Creighton did get their lead to 11 toward the end of the first half. X got sloppy on some switches. I think they let things get away from them a little bit. But, you know, I mean, the last two possessions of the first half about drove me crazy. But they did get two quick baskets in the interim to get it back down to 7. They had the ball. They had a terrible possession where they had the shot clock violation, gave up a tip-in at the other end. But at least they stopped the bleeding. And going in down 9 is a lot different than going in down, like, 13 or 14 with the other team on a massive run. So I thought they did a pretty good job in terms of keeping their defensive intensity where it needed to be. That Creighton run at the end of the first half, I think, also was a byproduct of X being forced into zone because of some fatigue and some foul trouble.
Yep.
And that 1-3-1, man, there are just some teams where it is just you are just playing Russian roulette
and they were in the 2-3 too. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
neither one was real effective for that period of time. But I thought they did okay out of the zone in the second half when they had to go to it. So it kind of was a weird situation.
Yeah,
Creighton's just a great offensive team also, and
that's
so
the thing.
They're going to beat your defense regardless of what you play.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a team of shooters, right? I mean, like, that's what they do, and if you're going to play zone, no matter what defense you play, you're going to give something up. And with Xavier's shortcomings right now in terms of having fewer bodies, not having much guard depth, all of those things, they're going to have to make some concessions on the defensive end. That's just the way it's going to work. And ideally, you wouldn't have to play much zone against Creighton, but today they were were able to do it. They kept playing hard, and it worked out. One thing that was interesting to me about kind of what you're talking about there, Dan, with them, you know, overcoming those stretches where they had the drought, but then they kind of make a little run at the end of the first half, and they respond in the second half. I was sitting in Fox 19 for the entire second half, their studios, with Brad Redford watching the game. And I think, like, when you hear former players talk in sound bites, you know, doing, like, the TV stuff, Brad's really good at all that stuff, and there's other players that have done a great job of it. But it's never nearly as interesting as, like, watching an extended period of a game with a former player who know, you know what I mean, like, who knows Chris Mack and what it's like in the huddle and everything. I was just – it was kind of cool sitting there with Brad and hearing him talk about his thoughts on what was going on. And he just – the one thing that I took away from that was just he's genuinely impressed with the way this team has responded to adversity, and not just, like – overall, in the sense that Edmund's down and all, they had the losing streak and everything, but more so even in games. You know, when something bad happens in a game, he's like, they don't let it get to them. They really, you know, they keep playing their game. They don't freak out at all. And he was impressed with that.
Yeah, I mean, and that was definitely true today. But that has not been the story of this team over their first 20 games.
I disagree. See, I think they do really do a good job of fighting through, like, even when they have extended droughts where they come back in those games. They weren't done. They didn't get run out of the gym and lose by 15 in those games where they had those long extended droughts that would put them away. They came back and nearly won those games despite having that terrible stretch. And, like, look, I get the argument of, well, if you go on those extended stretches, then you're obviously not very good at answering the bell. But I look from it more from the perspective of they have some shortcomings that are the issues, you know, and part of it's been, like, certain guys just not shooting up to their standards, like JP and Trayvon at different points of this year. But again, they've never let that wave, like, they've never given up on the defensive end. They've never given up in terms of their toughness, other than maybe you could argue in the UC game with the rebounding. So that would sort of be how I view it from that perspective.
Yeah, but UC, to a certain extent, they're on tilt right now. I mean, everything
really well.
Working for them, so you can almost understand it a little bit going back that way. I think the way that they were punked on the glass in that game was surprising, but it doesn't surprise me that UC, you know, won that battle. So moving into the second half, I mean, I think the biggest thing for me. So let's talk about the first, like, let's say 14 minutes of the second half. Xavier's down 9 at the break. They cut it to 3. There's a long period for about 8 minutes of gameplay where Xavier kept making sort of mini runs. They get back-to-back baskets. They get some free throws. They get it down to, you know, 3, 4, 5 points, and then Creighton would hit a 3, or Creighton would get inside. Creighton 13 of 28 from 3 for the game, which is obviously very good, in line with how good they've been from 3 all season. But the thing that was so interesting about that stretch is while it was a little bit frustrating that X couldn't get over the hump, there were a lot of guys that were showing during that period. Quentin Gooden hit several in-rhythm step-in threes. He hit 4 for the game, I believe.
Yeah, he's 4 for 7 on the game.
Kaiser Gates was extremely active offensively. Tyreek chimed in with a couple more baskets in the second half. Rashid was pretty good. You know, and then obviously Trayvon was sort of an omnipresent force. I mean, he didn't have the kind of dominant game that we've seen him have a couple times in recent weeks, but he hit a bunch of big shots as well to keep them close. And what that all did is it facilitated the run that they finally made to take the lead, starting at about the 5-minute mark to get it tied, and then obviously to take the lead going into the last 90 seconds or so of the game. What did you see anything in particular you liked during that period?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I just was shocked, Dan, by, like, you come into this game, you think, man, Trayvon better go off if they're going to have a chance. You know, he better get 25, 30 points. JP better get 20 if they're going to have a chance to win this. The fact that they were able to win it with Tyreek Jones and Quentin Gooden right there as their leading scorers, and even Kaiser Gates made a big play. Malcolm Bernard had that big floater in the lane. Rashid Gaston had some big moments on both offense and defense. I just did not expect all these guys to contribute in such a big game on the road when, quite honestly, that just hasn't been what this team's done all year. You know, they really haven't gotten that type of balanced performance in big games, especially on the road when they've needed it. So to see that today, to me, was just kind of shocking. And for it to come from Quentin Gooden and Tyreek Jones, again, that's just, it's got to have you really excited as a Xavier fan about the future.
Yeah, playing against a team that is that prides itself on the balance of its scoring, and I you know, halfway, I believe with like 4 minutes left in the first half, 9 guys for Creighton had already scored, which is pretty amazing. But you look at the box score for Xavier, 4 guys with 15 or 16 points, and then Kaiser at 9 and Rashid at 7. So they were getting lots of contributions from a lot of different guys. Quentin Gooden played 38 minutes, so check. There's one thing we didn't know that he could do. He went 4 for 7 on threes. Check. There's something we didn't know he could do.
By the way, when they were just daring him, playing inside the free throw line, trying to really help off of him and clog the lane, he made a big difference by hitting those threes. You know, it completely changed what Xavier was able to do offensively.
5 assists, 2 turnovers, and this is my favorite one. Because coming into this game, when you looked at Creighton, where were they weak? They got Davion Mintz and Tyler Clement running the point.
Mm-hmm.
5 steals.
Yep. And he's doing it in help, too. You know, he's doing it, reaching in when guys are driving by him. He's in the gap and reaching in and snatching the ball away.
Anyway, and you know, he was 1 for 10 on 2-point shots. And, yeah, sometimes he gets himself in there and he kind of throws up a floater, just hoping it drops in. And, you know, you would like to see him be a little more authoritative when he gets into the key. But, one or two of those drop and he scores 20 points. I mean, it was really a remarkable effort from him, and I thought the way that he kind of marshaled the offense during that long stretch of the second half before Xavier's shooters went off was really impressive and kept him in the game.
The least of my concerns about Quentin Gooden, and this goes back to the first time I ever evaluated Quentin Gooden as a high school player, all the way until today at 8:27 on Saturday evening, is him finishing at the rim. Like, that's going to be his strength. So for him to go 110 and get a shot blocked a bunch, he's going to be able to figure that out. He's got a 40-inch vertical. He's 200-and-something pounds, just absolutely jacked. Not a concern at all if he's going to be able to figure out how to finish around the rim. The things I didn't know he could do were make 4 of 7 from a 3, go 5-2 assist-to-turnover ratio in a big road environment against a good team, get 5 steals on the defensive end. He's doing all the things you want to see out of him, better than expected. So the finishing thing will come, and maybe it'll come this year, maybe it won't, maybe it'll be as a sophomore, sort of like we saw with Edmund. But either way, he's on the right trajectory without question.
All right, so then obviously the game really turns, I think. You know, you go into the under 4 tied, and I can't remember whether Trayvon had already hit the first of those 3 threes at that point or if it happened after that. I'm pulling up the play-by-play right now. So Xavier finally gets it tied going into the under 4, which was interesting because that's basically the exact situation they were in against Seton Hall, right? You know, Marcus Foster at the line shooting 2, he makes 1 of the 2, and then Trayvon hits a 3. Cole Huff, you know, shout out to Cole Huff, misses a 3 at the other end. X finds Trayvon on a ridiculous curl to get up 5. And then after Kyrie Thomas managed to hit a 3, which, by the way, was a garbage situation. So this is one of the things I loved about Xavier during this stretch. They played such good defense.
Mm-hmm.
They were really, really intense. They were really up in the grill of Creighton's guards, putting a lot of pressure on them.
And for the most part, without fouling.
For the most part, without fouling. And another thing was they were very active on cuts, because mm-hmm. that's been something where Xavier's gotten beat a lot this year, I feel like. And certainly against Patton, that's something that's always a risk. Is he flips it out to the wing? A guy plays a return pass, and all of a sudden you've got a 7-foot monster coming at you trying to dunk everything.
Dan,
and a couple times Xavier got their hands up and chopped those passes away and got steals.
To that point, you're dead on. Creighton, I just looked this up on Synergy last night, is literally the number one team in the country in points per possession efficiency on cuts, like play types being cuts. They're number one in the country in efficiency on that. Dead on. And it's because of what you said,
that's
Patton.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a huge key in this game, and you're right. Xavier did a great job of taking that away, being active, being alert.
So after Blewett hits those 2 threes, X is up 75-70 with 2:37. Then Xavier has maybe one of their best defensive possessions of the game, I thought, where they They forced Marcus Foster into a terrible shot, really closely guarded 18-footer. He throws up an air ball. It falls right into Patton's hands under the basket, or falls right into Huff's hands under the basket, who's completely out of position. And then he feeds Khyree Thomas for a three. And that moment, if you've watched this team and you've seen the way that they've kind of struggled in close games against good teams down the stretch, that's the moment where you stick your hand over your face and go, oh, no. Yep. Here we go again.
You said they fought, Xavier, but just not enough.
Xavier goes right down the floor. JP steps out about 5 feet past the three-point line. It's not an open three, but in his mind, it's open enough, and he drills and he drills a bomb right there to restore the five-point lead. I mean, obviously, at some point, it doesn't really matter what kind of offense you were. It's just making shots. But how did you break down those three situations for Xavier at that point in the game?
I honestly don't even know what to say, because it's you said it, like, it was okay. This is kind of the point where they just don't have quite enough. You know, they're not like they're going to have to make some big shots, and quite honestly, they just haven't been able to do that consistently enough. They're on the road. There's, what was it, 16,000 fans there or something, I heard. Like, it was a ridiculous number. And then they just proceed to keep making big plays. JP's shot was, me and Redford were just cracked up laughing, because it was just like, what the hell are you? Oh, all right. Okay. That's Jonathan Paul being Jonathan Paul, I guess. Not much you can do about that. So, yeah, I know that wasn't great analysis, but that was basically my thoughts during that moment. Not much to explain it, not much precedent for that to happen, but this team found a way to make plays, and it was multiple guys doing it.
There was there was another great defensive possession just off of that. Clement scored, and then Rashid split a pair at the line, where Patton got the ball low on the block, and Xavier just did a really, really nice job of forcing him away from the basket. He ends up taking kind of I want to say it was like a fadeaway 12-footer, maybe on the left baseline, leaves it short. Trayvon grabs a rebound. You know, another example of Xavier really just producing a really good defensive effort at a key time. And then things got a little bit problematic, shall we say.
Yeah. I thought...
Because at that point, there's 53 seconds left. Xavier is up by 4 points. At that point, Creighton has three team fouls. So basically, all they're going to be trying to do at that... All they're going to try to do, in a typical game, what you would expect to happen is Xavier would run a bunch of inbound plays. Creighton would foul them to the point that they would be able to put Xavier in the bonus. And then maybe they defend one possession and try to play it out from there, or they just foul Xavier and then it becomes that chess game. But things did not play out quite the way you would expect them to.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Paul giveth and Jonathan Paul taketh away. I mean, here's the thing. A lot of people are going to point to Edmund Sumner not being there for those inbounds plays. Yes, you're a little easier to guard if you don't have Edmund Sumner in the lineup. But guess what? Quentin Gooden's plenty athletic, too, to get open as well. And he's not easy to stay in front of. So if it's just about getting the ball into someone, then I don't think that was your biggest issue. And second of all, you shouldn't be trying to get the ball to Edmund Sumner in that situation anyway. You should be getting the ball to Trayvon Blewett, which is what they were trying to do. And he and JP could not connect. Two juniors that have been together for 3 years need to connect in that situation. It's as simple as that. Like, I don't know what you can say other than figure it out. Complete that pass. They know what they were running. I thought most of the passes were open for the most part. They just had like weird miscommunications. And again, a big key was what you said, which is Creighton only had three team fouls. So they were able to be super aggressive and just go all in on the ball, basically. And if you foul, great. You're trying to anyways. But go all in after the steal. And I think that made it a little more difficult. But it's just a situation that your experienced guys have to be better in.
Right. So what from your perspective is the if it's Coach Broering, how are you running those inbounds plays? I mean, who do you have triggering the ball inbounds, and what kind of actions would you be running to try and get your guy the ball?
I mean, it's just – it's not rocket science, right? Like, it's what they're doing, which is you run a screen and a screen or a switch and kind of just have one man cut hard and one man roll, and you get the ball in the short corner because that's where you're able to get it in, and you let them foul you, which is what they were trying to do. You didn't even need to get the ball across half court. All you needed to do was complete an inbounds pass. And to be quite honest, I would hope I could trust J.P. McCura to inbound the ball. Like, he's one of my most experienced guys, and he's skilled. So I don't know why they couldn't get it in, but like after JP screwed it up two times, I might have considered going to. But like, who are you going to put in? Quentin Gooden? You're going to put the freshman in that situation and the most athletic guy that's an outlet. So it's really tough to change up in that situation. You got to have Trayvon receiving. He's your best free throw shooter, plus a big body to throw to.
That's an interesting point, Rick, because at the end of both the Georgetown game at home a couple weeks ago and the Seton Hall game, Trayvon was the inbounds man on a couple of those possessions late in the game. And as a, you know, a dope watching the game from the stands, it's like, why would you have probably your most reliable free throw shooter inbounding the ball in those situations? Now today it wasn't that way.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't even realize that. Now it's a good point.
I'm probably 100% wrong. Don't at me.
No. I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying that would make sense because their four man typically inbounds the ball, which would be Trayvon. But I just thought they didn't do that in end of game scenarios because they wanted Trayvon catching the ball. That's interesting that they've switched that up.
But in those games, it might have been, that, especially in the Georgetown game, Xavier might have been ahead far enough that they didn't feel like they needed to do that. But I'm pretty sure in the Seton Hall game, a couple times in that last minute, they had Trayvon throwing the ball in bounds. But they didn't know Seton Hall was going to foul either.
Right. That's interesting.
So can I complain about the refs for a second?
Sure.
Okay.
I saw. I'll be honest. Like, again, I was in studio. We were watching the game, but I felt like I missed maybe some of the ref stuff because the fans were. I saw a lot of tweets that were unhappy about the officiating.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think the fact that Creighton had three team fouls 19 and a half minutes in the game the second half was a little bit crazy.
But yeah, that is.
Maybe that's right. I don't know. I'm not. There were a couple calls that went down that I thought were kind of the Trayvon technical was just a
what happened there.
So
I missed that completely. What happened?
So Trayvon had got his pocket picked to half court and he kind of gotten abused in the process. The guy goes down and dunks and Trayvon's just talking to the ref all the way up.
Right.
All the way up the thing. And finally the ref makes a big show of pointing at him to tell him to shut up. Trayvon turns around. I guess some of the sound waves from his voice must have reached the ref in a building with 17,000 people going ballistic, and he teed him up, and it's just
like if typical. Here's the thing. That's what I saw. I saw Trayvon turn back around and run down the other end of the court when he pointed. So I thought, like, even if Trayvon's saying something under his breath at that point, if he's not showing you up, if he's listened to you and is turning around to run down the other end, as a ref, that's don't
like
get rabbit ears. Yeah, don't get rabbit ears at that point. You're in a loud arena. Just shut that out. That was bizarre.
And then there was a call a little bit later in the game on where I think it was Thomas got under the basket on a reverse layup, throws up a ridiculous shot, hits the underside of the rim, and the ball like rebounds to Gaston. Like Xavier's getting ready to run the ball the other way, and they blow a whistle for a foul on the shot, which seemed like a total. It seemed like one of those things. You know, this happens with refs where if the shot goes in, there's no foul. If the shot misses, they call a foul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think that was one of those, and the whistle was just way late. But on these inbounds plays, if you go back and you watch them, the amount of grabbing going on from Creighton is absolutely ridiculous. And the thing was that after they let him get away with it on Trayvon on the first one, it got worse and worse. And as the crowd got louder and more intense, I think the referees, you know, they're only human. They kind of are enjoying this, riding this wave of emotion. So by the third one, Clement has Trayvon in like a half Nelson in front of the foul line. He's got one of his arms is locked behind him, and this was the play where JP tried to lead him and nobody touched the ball.
Yeah,
because the kid had him completely locked down.
I did think that one was a you know what it felt like? It felt a lot like when Xavier used to play VCU.
I'll tell you what specifically it reminded me of was a certain game at a certain barn in the capital city of Indiana wherein Mark Lyons was assaulted by human octopus Gordon Hayward from like all possible angles, and the refs, you know, gave the precious jump puppies ball. A jump ball instead of called the foul, which they so richly deserved, and the whole clock water fountain thing would have never happened had they made the right call. But that's just my opinion, Rick.
People do not forget that.
People will never forget that.
Ever.
Although I think, do you think that that clock fiasco was more or less egregious than the one in the Georgia A&M game last week? Did you see that?
No. I'm not.
Well, it was
familiar.
A similar situation where Georgia had the ball. I think they were down a point. And
Georgia State?
Georgia Bulldogs.
Oh, okay.
They're playing at Texas A&M. Georgia's got the ball with like 6 or 7 seconds left. The Georgia player's dribbling the ball. The clock doesn't start. So he doesn't think he's got no time. He takes a couple extra dribbles, shakes his man, gets under the basket, gets fouled right before the buzzer. And then they go to the clock and they figure out that the clock didn't start for like 2 seconds, so they wave off the foul and the game's over.
Yeah.
I think both of those are just terrible, because to me, if the clock is not accurate while gameplay is going on, then how can you judge the player's behavior based on what the clock theoretically should say?
Agreed.
You know what I mean?
Agreed. Here's what I'd say. The second one is a bad rule. That's the officials enforcing the rules properly, but it's a bad rule that's what you do, is you go back, you review it, and then you just say, oh, the game was over 2 seconds prior. Sorry, that's it. Because you're right. That's a stupid rule. You can't do it that way. But they enforced it correctly, from what I understand, because I've seen that happen in other times. The Butler thing was just terrible officiating.
Right. All right. So, well, and also that Butler's, let's just say that I have some questions.
No, they're cheating. Like, they're flat out cheating with the clock.
Maybe,
it's been proven.
I think that maybe a federal commission should investigate whoever runs Butler's hourglass courtside. I'm just saying.
It's a proven fact that they're cheating with that clock, because it's not the Xavier thing anymore. It's well beyond. It's been proven in so many other games at this point where other teams have had trouble there. So they're flat out cheating with the clock. That's a fact.
All right. So beyond that, let's see. We had Kaiser Gates doing a nice job on defense.
Also with three drives to the basket.
Yeah, he did on a couple of them, but the one that Kyrie Thomas missed looked like one where Kaiser got beat, realized, well, he makes this, we still got 10 seconds to win the game, and just basically let him go. Because he didn't want to foul him and give up the N1, and Thomas was so open he panicked.
I think Thomas got away with a little bit of a travel there, and it caught.
You thought it was?
I think it caught Kaiser off guard a little bit, but I agree with you. It wasn't great defense, and I don't know how the heck he missed that layup, which goes back to neither team really wanting to win this game in those final 2 minutes. But I thought Kaiser Gates. First of all, the crossover where he just blitzed Tegner and got to the rim was hilarious to watch, and I didn't even know he knew how to do that. And then
he also hit a big three late in the second half.
He did hit a big three, but he had a couple other drives to the basket too. He finished one and got fouled on another. So, I mean, three different drives to the rim now. Like, that's, and again, it's a good job by him recognizing he had a good matchup on that he could take advantage of, but he didn't have the confidence to do that when he came in. And a lot of people I see people saying, oh, Kaiser needs to do that more. I bet the coaches are on him to do that more or whatever. To be quite honest, that's not the case. Like, the coaches have been happy that he understands his strengths and his weaknesses and has not been turning the ball over trying to dribble when he hasn't been able to do it. But the fact that he now is showing, hey, if I get the right matchup, I have enough confidence now, means he's really come a long way since he got on campus with his ball handling ability.
Yeah, and then also, it was big that after he got the rebound off of that miss, he made both free throws to force it out to a two-possession game, which promptly turned into bad craziness.
And by the way, he had 9 rebounds again, which I think he's had 9, 8, and 9 in the last 3 games.
Yeah, he's been really good on the glass in the last three games. I thought the previous game against Seton Hall was, in my opinion, the best all-around game he's had at Xavier.
Agreed.
Probably just eclipsing the Butler game at home last year.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this – I think there was a St. John's game last year where he scored a bunch of
points. Yeah, but those other two are much more meaningful.
Yeah, so this was a this was a big game for him, obviously. But then what did you make of what did you make of Creighton after Quentin missed that front end at the very end? I mean, it's surprising that doesn't happen more often, honestly.
Oh, the turnover pass?
Yeah.
I mean, What can you make it of other than what the hell were they doing? Like, I think those were my exact words. Like, what are you doing? Just give the ball to your – you have plenty of time.
Yeah, I mean, if Zierden catches that ball – if Hagner hits Zierden with that pass, I'm like 90% sure he makes the shot, and I don't care where he shoots it from.
Absolutely.
Just because of the way this season is generally gone. But yeah, I mean, that was insane. And then the best thing about it was is Xavier still couldn't get the ball inbound cleanly with 1 second left.
Yeah.
Although obviously it didn't really matter, but it was just kind of. It was the right way for that game to end.
It was comical. The entire last 2 minutes were comical.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess the issue is, the question is this something, so obviously this is a big win for Xavier. It fills in a line item on their resume they didn't have. It probably solidified, I mean, hell, they may jump back into the rankings next week. It solidifies kind of their position. It probably solidifies them off the NCAA tournament bubble, although we're obviously a long way from Selection Sunday. But is this something, can they carry like this momentum, or do you look at this and say this game was such a complete one-off with both teams trying to give it away?
No.
It's kind of worthless going forward.
No, I think it absolutely is a big building block, and it's not just this one. It's having been able to respond from the UC loss with three straight wins, and you know, you lose Edmund at St. John's, you finish that one off even though it wasn't a sure thing. You do the same thing against Seton Hall at home, and then it's like, well, okay, that's great, but that's at home. Well, now you do it against Creighton, and no matter how ugly it was or whatever, you made enough plays to win. You know, that's what I always say. Like, you can say whatever you want about the luck and the bad breaks and things, but if you found a way to win, you did enough. You know, you scored enough points that game, you got enough contributions that you won the game. That's all that matters. And to see that they were able to do it, and again, that they were able to do it without a 40-point performance from Trayvon or anything crazy like that, that they were able to do it with Quentin Gooden making plays and Tyreek Jones making plays and really carrying them inside and everyone stepping up at different points, I think it's a big momentum boost, and I think it helps build chemistry. And like I said, I think it's kind of changed the narrative. Now, that could change real quickly because this team's margin for error is going to be tiny going forward. I mean, mm-hmm. They could just – like the DePaul games are going to be worrisome, I think, for Xavier fans because you cannot lose either one of those games. You lose either one of those games and all of a sudden Xavier's resume starts looking a lot more like a Seton Hall or a Georgetown. And those teams are like first four out, first 10 out type teams right now, you know? So it's for Xavier, I think you've got to avoid both the Paul losses without question. But this is a huge one for NCAA tournament seeding. It's interesting when you look at the bubble, one of the things that I don't think a lot of people are just taking into consideration that's given Xavier a big boost is that in the non-conference, they didn't play any 250s or 300s. You know, mm-hmm. They played teams basically inside the top 150. There's one or two teams that were outside of it, but no one outside of the top 200 and a lot of top 100 games. So that just really skewed the metrics because they didn't lose any of those games. You know, obviously the Colorado loss is what it is, but it skewed the metrics because they got so many just, you know, decent wins in terms of RPI and all of that type of stuff. So their strength of schedule, RPI, all that is phenomenal because of that. And it's really helped skew a lot of the other metrics in their favor when you start looking at the different resumes, because the bubble is atrocious right now.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, there's a lot of really awful teams. One thing that strikes me as interesting is that Xavier currently on their schedule has zero games against teams over 200 in KenPom, And I just pulled up UC's schedule because it was easy to click to, and I think they have something like 8 or 9 on their schedule when you go through the whole thing.
But it's not just UC.
Which isn't to say Xavier is as good as UC. They're not, but I mean, I think that demonstrates that even relatively teams that you would say are probably on the cusp of being in that elite level in college basketball or have a lot of those games on their schedule, and Xavier does not.
Yeah.
And their strength of schedule in KenPom is 10th in the country at this point.
If you look around the rest of the Big East, Dan, like those other teams, the Marquettes, the Seton Hall, those teams have played a lot of those games. And that's quite honestly why that and the fact that Xavier doesn't have the bad loss, that each of those teams have at least one bad loss on their resume, that's why Xavier's so far ahead of them right now in terms of seeding. If you look, I mean, I think according to the bracket matrix, which has become my favorite, kind of the consensus, taking all the different bracketologies into account, Xavier's the second or third seventh seed basically right now in terms of consensus. So,
which is before the Creighton win,
right? Before the Creighton win, exactly.
So looking at the, and now all of a sudden it's like, okay, you're right. I mean, if Xavier were to honk to DePaul on Wednesday at home, that this all becomes very interesting again from one perspective. But then you look at the Big East standings right now, and Xavier's alone in second place, one game back in the loss column of Villanova, with Villanova coming to their gym next weekend.
Right. Like Xavier can still realistically win the Big East right now when you look at what's left on their schedule.
It's kind of insane.
Yeah. It's a credit to the coaching staff. It really is. You got to give them a lot, and the players, but you got to give the coaching staff a lot of credit.
Well, X is sitting at 7-3. Creighton and Butler both have 4 losses currently. They play each other, or no, they don't. I'm sorry. Butler is at Marquette on Tuesday, which will be an interesting game. Marquette has 5 league losses at the moment. It's a season that right now feels like it's balanced on a knife's edge because let's assume they beat DePaul. Well, on the one hand, you're in a situation where if they could somehow upset Villanova and Cincinnati, all of a sudden they have a chance to win the Big East. And if you win the Big East, you're probably getting a 4 seed at worst, right? Or better.
Right.
But then on the other hand, let's say they beat DePaul, and then Villanova comes in and beats them. Now they're looking down the barrel of 3 straight road games against Marquette, against Seton Hall, against Providence. You probably would hope that they could beat Providence away, but that's by no means a done deal.
Yeah.
And Seton Hall has been a house of horrors for Xavier over the years, and Marquette is a pretty good team. So then you're like, well, if they lose to Villanova, what if they're sitting on 4 losses in a row when they come back to play, you know, Butler and Marquette toward the end of the season? So there's just a lot of different. This has been one of those seasons where you never really feel like you have this team figured out.
No, but I think that's what that win did for me today. Is it made me say, you know what, they're going to win at least one of those 3 road games. You know what I mean? Because I was wondering, could they even, without Edmund, could they realistically go and win any of those road games? That was a legit question. And I had originally said, I think they need to win both DePaul games, split this week, which was Seton Hall and Creighton, win one of the road games, and then split one of the last 2 games. And so that's, you know, now that they've won both of these games and they won a big one on the road, the toughest road game they had left, I think all they have to do now is win the 2 DePaul games and win one of those road games, and they're guaranteed in that large bid, in my opinion, because they won't have a bad loss. And when you look at all the metrics at the bubble, they're going to be on the inside. I have almost no doubt about that. If they win both DePaul games and one of the 3 road games. Now, if they do better than that, I think they're in an interesting – they could be anywhere. You're right. This season is the most fun season for me from a perspective of covering the team that I've had yet, just because there's been storylines since the second this season started, and the narrative keeps changing. New storylines keep popping up. It's just an incredibly interesting season for a team that's really been nationally relevant since the get-go, you know? And they could be on the bubble, theoretically, and yet they've still been nationally relevant and talked about all season long.
So I want your take on one last thing before we quit, because I think that's a good place to stop. I don't know if you saw the highlights of this, but St. Bonaventure versus VCU. in A-10 play tonight. Bonnie's hit a three to give them an apparent win with a one-point lead with 0.4 seconds left. Some people start to mill out onto the court at that point, even though there's four-tenths of a second left. All of a sudden, the clock flips to 0-0. The crowd rushes the court. The referees call a technical. Are you good with that? Do you think that's a situation where, first of all, from a philosophical standpoint, are you pro the whole technical foul if the fans rush the floor early, or do you think that's nonsense? And secondly, in a situation like that, what do you think they should have done?
One, no, I think that's a dumb rule. The only thing I guess I would understand if you come back at me with, well, what else is really going to stop fans? You know, like the one thing you could really maybe kind of hold above their heads is, hey, you're going to cost your team a win. So like they're not going to care about getting the university fined, right? Like we've seen that in the past. That doesn't help. So I think maybe that makes sense to me, is the fact that it's the only thing that might deter fans from running on the court. So if that's the rule, then okay, you got to do it. But man, what a way to lose the game. That being said, I never feel bad for seeing St. Bonaventure lose, just like I never feel bad for seeing Fordham lose, because they made me watch tons of crappy basketball games for the last few years, and I don't feel bad about that one bit.
I sort of agree with you. I mean, St. Bonaventure, I mean, they've been involved in so many controversies. I remember in the early years of the A-10, there was the situation where their game against UMass got delayed because somebody threw a cookie at John Calipari.
You just can't have that.
No, you can't have that. I guess they get fired up in Olean. I guess there's nothing else to do. But
why wouldn't you?
But here's my thing about it. Like, if the fans are intentionally, if it's a situation where the fans are intentionally obstructing the gameplay, like, I think there was a situation many, many years ago where, like, fans, like, en masse threw tennis balls onto the court or something like that because some player on the other team had been arrested for some sort of tennis-related shenanigans. I think it was Dwayne Shinsius back in Florida a long time ago. That, to me, yeah, you call a technical foul. Or if somebody, like, interferes with play, or if they're grabbing guys like they sometimes do at Duke, I'm cool with calling a technical foul. Or when David West was shooting the technical foul shots at St. Joseph's 10 years ago and the crowd was, like, throwing bottles and stuff on the floor.
Yeah.
I'm good with that.
Right.
But in a situation like this where the crowd didn't really rush onto the floor until the clock showed double zeros.
Right.
I mean, just clear off the floor and play the last four-tenths of a second.
That's seem like a common sense situation, right? Like where you could just say, well, this is a little bit different because we said the game was over on the clock, so let's just go ahead and clear it off. I agree with you on
that. And they do it in football all the time.
Right.
When like there's a penalty on the last play or something like that, and they don't call a 15-yard penalty on the home team.
Right.
So I think common sense needs to dictate the response there. I think common sense should dictate the response to those clock issues we talked about as well.
I'm with you.
But common sense and college refereeing, not maybe.
Common sense in this world, Dan. Not agreeing.
Oh, man. I could, yeah.
We'll leave it there. You've been listening to another edition of the Dan and Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.